Biden administration comes under growing criticism over a surge in migrant arrivals as new photos show the squalid conditions of immigrants at a U.S.-Mexico border. The UN chief voices his concern about the rise of violence against Asians following the killing of six Asian American women in a shooting spree in Atlanta. The death toll from Sunday's coordinated gun attacks on villages in southwestern Niger rises to 137. This is World News coming to you live from the Iranian capital, Tehran. It's good to have you. Our top story, new photos have emerged showing the squalid conditions of immigrants being kept at a processing center near the U.S.-Mexico border. Migrants could be seen crowding together and sleeping on a floor at a border facility in Donna, Texas. The photos came amid criticism of U.S. President Joe Biden's policy regarding immigration, as record numbers of asylum seekers have been flooding into the country. The White House is particularly under fire for the conditions in overcrowded detention centers for unaccompanied immigrant children. More than 10,000 kids, including many of those forcibly separated from their parents, are now in the care of the Department of Health and Human Services. 5,000 others are also stranded in Border Patrol facilities not designed for long-term custody. Earlier, we were joined by our correspondent in Washington, D.C., Colin Campbell, who told us more about the immigrant crisis at the United States border with Mexico.
The fact of the matter is there is an issue happening at the border. Some would characterize it as a crisis. As we're getting more people who are coming to the border, there are less facilities to process these people who want to come in. And, of course, this can create crisis-like conditions. And it's up to the Biden administration to really do something about this. This is really bad for the administration, especially since a lot of people voted for the current administration because of the atrocities that happened from the last administration. And some would say were caused by the previous administration before that, the Obama administration, that created some of these detention facilities that some would characterize as less than humane. And so what we have is a situation at the border where you have an influx of people with very few places to go. Sometimes children are just coming across looking for a new opportunity, and they don't have there's no way or proper process to get these children through and get them either asylum or to put them through the due process to get them any kind of citizenship. It's just not happening.
Well, several people, including a police officer, have been killed in a shooting incident at a shopping mall in the U.S. city of Boulder, Colorado. Local police forces, as well as FBI officers, have been dispatched to the scene to respond to quote an armed and dangerous individual. The shooter has been apprehended. However, the police have issued a shelter-in-place order, urging the residents to avoid the area. There is no immediate information on the shooter's identity or motive. The United States loses around 33,000 people to gun violence every year. Additionally, more than 100,000, I should say, people are shot each year in the country. Now moving on, the UN Secretary General has voiced concern about rising violence against Asians and people of Asian descent across the globe. Antonio Guterres said Asian communities around the world have been increasingly targeted by verbal and physical attacks as well as bullying, both in schools or on social media. He added that in some countries, Asian women have been specifically targeted, which adds a misogynistic angle to the already racist move. Although he didn't name any specific country, the UN chief's comments come in the aftermath of a shooting spree in the U.S. city of Atlanta, which left six women of Asian descent dead. A spate of hate crimes against the Asian American community in the U.S. has sparked a public outcry across the country. Activist and political commentator Medea Benjamin says the U.S. foreign policy regarding China has added fuel to the fire of racism in the country. Here's more.
Well, I think one of the things that's not being talked about enough is connecting the racism to U.S. foreign policy, and particularly the anti-China policy. It was not only President Trump who talked about the Kung Flu and the China virus, but also we now see Biden's Secretary of State in his opening meeting with the Chinese representatives chastising them instead of conducting real diplomacy. And the messages that are coming from the U.S. government are ones that China is our enemy, that we have to build up our military to confront China. And all of this adds to the anti-Asian American sentiment in the United States. So we're calling on the Biden administration not only to denounce the these as hate crimes, but also to stop the Cold War with China.
The death toll from Sunday's gun attacks in Niger's Tahoua region has risen to 137. Security officials say the deaths occurred when armed men on motorbikes raided three villages near the border with Mali and Burkina Faso. A government spokesman said armed bandits now systematically target civilians and slam the bloodshed as brutal and horrific. No group has yet claimed responsibility, but officials have blamed the attacks on Daesh terrorists and their affiliates. Violence has surged in the Niger border areas in recent weeks. On March 15th, 66 people were killed in a similar raid in the Talabéri region. A massive fire has swept through a Rohingya refugee camp in the southeastern Bangladeshi coastal town of Cox's Bazar, killing several people. Fire services and rescue teams were dispatched to the scene to deal with the crisis. However, hundreds of tents and a number of health and other facilities are said to have been destroyed. According to local officials, five people were feared dead, and some 20,000 camp dwellers were forced to flee. This was the third fire to hit the settlement in 4 days. But the cause of the incident is still unknown. The Cox's Bazar refugee camp is home to about 100,000 refugees who had fled a state-sponsored crackdown in Myanmar's Rakhine State. About 1 million Rohingya Muslims have crossed into Bangladesh since 2017. The United States, Canada, and Britain have denounced China for alleged human rights violations of the country's ethnic Uyghur Muslim community in the Xinjiang region. In a joint statement, the foreign ministers of the three countries called for justice for the people being suffered in the Chinese autonomous region. They, along with the European Union, also imposed sanctions on several Chinese officials over alleged abuse of Uyghurs. China has expressed disappointment over the move, describing it as a wrong decision. Beijing also hit back by slapping sanctions on 10 European individuals and four entities. China said the EU's action is based on lies and disinformation and amounts to gross interference in the country's internal affairs. Meanwhile, EU foreign policy chief Josep Borrell slammed China's retaliatory sanctions as unacceptable. Political commentator Wilmer Leon says the sanctions imposed on Beijing are the result of a failed meeting between the U.S. and China in Alaska. Here's more.
I think that's a very good and accurate assessment, particularly coming out of what I would call the failed meetings in Alaska on Friday, as the United States came into the meeting trying to lecture China as though China were some type of a subordinate country. So now you have the EU issuing sanctions, and the way that the BBC reports it is that this was a coordinated effort between the United States, the UK, Canada, and the EU. So in response to that, China is taking matters into its own hands and letting the world know that it is a sovereign nation, that it is a power a nation that needs to be respected and will not be taken advantage of.
North Korea has called on China to strengthen unity and cooperation between the two countries. In a verbal message that is to Beijing, North Korean leader Kim Jong-un praised his country's close ties with China and expressed hope to boost it further. He also called for intensifying and a strategic communication between the two sides. Earlier on Monday, in a similar message, Chinese President Xi Jinping said his country is willing to work with Pyongyang to preserve peace and stability on the Korean Peninsula. The calls are seen as a clear message to Washington, as both have accused the U.S. President Joe Biden of following in footsteps of his predecessor, Donald Trump. U.S. President Joe Biden has adopted a tough stance against Russia, China, and North Korea, which in recent days have pushed back at the U.S. It appears that the U.S. has not only abandoned the diplomatic route, but has taken a military approach by threatening North Korea.
U.S. President Joe Biden's administration has already started a war of words with countries it deems adversaries, namely North Korea, China, and Russia. The rhetoric between Washington and Beijing escalated after U.S. State Secretary Antony Blinken's trip to South Korea and Japan, where he leveled allegations against China and North Korea, expressing concern about their activities. The first high-level in-person talks between top American and Chinese diplomats revealed the extent of the rift in their bilateral ties. The two-day meeting held in Alaska saw the two sides trading barbs over a host of issues during the opening session, which usually takes minutes to complete, but in this case lasted for well over an hour. The Biden administration has also taken a hardline stance against the other U.S. rival, Russia, with the State Department threatening sanctions on any entity that would get involved in the development of the Nord Stream 2 project, a pipeline which would stretch from Russia to Germany. The U.S. has accused Russia of trying to influence the 2020 presidential election. In an interview, Biden said Russia will, quote, pay a price for attempting to meddle in the election, while suggesting that his Russian counterpart, Vladimir Putin, was a killer.
The U.S. A big brother policy, if you want to call it that, is also targeting the Europeans, trying to stop the very important pipeline between Russia and Germany, and they're attacking the very interests of those people that they're trying to bring on board. All these countries have different relations with China and different relations with Russia, and we saw how the Europeans reacted, or didn't react, I would say, to Biden's, you know, outrageous claims that Putin was a killer. Nobody is backing him up, and I think they were very shocked by the words of the president, and they're not very happy with the results of that, and certainly doesn't represent their opinion.
Moscow, Beijing, and Pyongyang, on their part, have responded to the hostile remarks. Yet the fiery U.S. statements are reminiscent of foreign policy adopted by the hawkish administration of former U.S. President Donald Trump.
2 months into Biden's presidency, the U.S. has imposed new sanctions against Russian and Chinese individuals. Washington has also recently threatened war with North Korea. Tensions over the disputed South China Sea are also at their all-time high. The Biden administration is yet to announce its approach regarding the three nations, but its foreign policy is certainly not off to a good start. What's the U.S. endgame here? Is it after brinkmanship or going to fight on three fronts?
Pyongyang was quick to respond to the U.S. threats. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un's influential sister on Tuesday warned the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden against, quote, causing a stink at its first step if it wanted to sleep in peace for the next 4 years. Kim Yo-jong, who is a key advisor to her brother, denounced the annual joint U.S.-South Korea military drills, which began earlier this month, saying war drills and hostility can never go with dialogue and cooperation. But the U.S. later clarified its position on North Korea, with Pentagon Chief Lloyd Austin saying Washington was ready to, quote, fight tonight. U.S. officials' incendiary remarks prompted a response from China as well. Beijing has noted that the U.S. has no longer the qualification to speak to China from a position of power. In the meantime, Russian President Vladimir Putin hit back at Biden, who had called him a killer, saying it takes one to know one. Also, Russia recalled its ambassador to the U.S. for consultations.
So the U.S. is playing a very dangerous game because they think that they're leading this big troop of international nations to meet the so-called autocracies, i.e. Russia and China, whereas I think if they look behind them, they're going to see that their army is quickly fading and disappearing and going their own way. But it's a dangerous situation because they're pursuing that. The United States is still, you know, probably militarily, undoubtedly, the most powerful country in the world. They could bring the world to war, and that's where the danger is. But I think most of the other countries are rational enough to understand that pursuing a path of trying to contain or delimit or even undermine the sovereign governments of Russia and China, or either one of those, is a very dangerous game that will only lead to military conflict. And I think they're not going to be on board that policy.
Many observers expected the Biden era to mark a departure from Trump's hawkish policies. Just over 2 months into his presidency, however, Biden has set the tone for what the world can expect for at least the next 4 years.
Jordan has registered more than 100 new coronavirus deaths, the record single-day fatalities since the disease first appeared in the kingdom. The Jordanian Health Ministry also reported over 9,200 new cases in 24 hours. The latest figure have pushed the country's overall death toll to nearly 6,000 out of over 500,000 cases so far. Meanwhile, Turkey logged over 22,000 new daily cases, the highest since mid-December. Turkish officials have so far recorded more than 30,000 deaths and some 3 million confirmed cases. Officials in several countries, including Jordan, have blamed new variants for the recent surge in cases. Meanwhile, the World Health Organization has warned of shortcomings in vaccine distributions, especially to poorer countries. The body said that an unequal allocation would lead to the emergence of more variants.
The gap between the number of vaccines administered in rich countries and the number of vaccines administered through COVAX is growing every single day and becoming more grotesque every day.
Ghebreyesus said it was shocking to see how little had been done to avert an entirely, quote, predictable catastrophic moral failure to ensure the equitable distribution of vaccines. The WHO chief noted that the inequitable distribution is not just a moral outrage, but also self-defeating economically and epidemiologically. So far, over 123 million coronavirus cases have been reported globally. The virus has also claimed more than 2.7 million lives so far. Indian farmers have held a rally, this time in the southern city of Bangalore, against the government's contentious farm laws. Police used batons to disperse the protesters. The demonstrators also called for a statewide shutdown on Friday to mark 4 months of farmers' protests near the capital, New Delhi. Indian farmers are angry over a set of laws enacted in last September. They argue the agricultural reforms would leave them at the mercy of big corporations. Nearly a dozen rounds of talks between farmers and government representatives, that is, have failed to make a breakthrough. Several rallies, including the one on the country's Republic Day, turned violent, leaving one dead and dozens injured. And that is your world news for now.
A diverse range of programs. Youth. Spirituality. culture, Eastern tales, roundtable discussions, politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Around the globe, the coronavirus pandemic is racking up mind-blowing bills. Trillions of dollars in lost tax revenues, ramped-up spending, and new borrowings set to burden the next generation with record levels of debt. In the direst of cases, low- and middle-income countries, mostly in Africa and Latin America, that are already saddled with back-breaking debt, covering the rising costs is transforming into a high-stakes test of national solvency. We now present you an article written jointly by Alexander Villegas and Anthony Fayola and Leslie Roughton. The piece is titled, As Spending Climbs and Revenue Falls, Coronavirus Forces a Global Reckoning. The article has been taken from the Washington Post. Costa Rica built Latin America's model society, enacting universal health care and spending its way to one of the Western Hemisphere's highest literacy rates. But now, it's reeling from financially crushing side effects of the coronavirus, as cratering revenues and crisis spending forces a reckoning over a massive pile of government debt. The coronavirus pandemic is hurtling heavily leveraged nations into an economic danger zone, threatening to bankrupt the worst affected. Costa Rica, a country known for ziplining tourists and American retirees, is scrambling to stave off a full-blown debt crisis, imposing emergency cuts and proposing harsher measures that touched off rare violent protests last autumn. To keep the lights on, a progressive, eco-friendly nation is weighing desperate solutions, including open-pit gold mining, even oceanic fracking. Around the globe, the coronavirus pandemic is racking up mind-blowing bills, trillions of dollars in lost tax revenues, ramped-up spending and new borrowing set to burden the next generation with record levels of debt. In the direst of cases, low- and middle-income countries, mostly in Africa and Latin America, that are already saddled with back-breaking debt, covering the rising costs, is transforming into a high-stakes test of national solvency. Analysts call it a debt tsunami. National accounts are sinking into the red at a record level. According to the Institute of International Finance, by the end of 2020, total government debt worldwide was projected to soar by $9 trillion and top 103% of global gross domestic product or GDP. A historic jump of more than 10 percentage points in just 1 year. Countries have maxed out their figurative credit cards to buy medical equipment, set up field hospitals, deployed healthcare workers and sourced vaccines, even as pandemic-related recessions have caused tax revenues to plunge and aid for the unemployed to spike. Countries that rely on tourism, which has ground to a virtual halt, or commodities like oil that have sunk in price have felt the sting most keenly. The United States itself has run up debt at a pace not seen since the Second World War. but the world's wealthy nations are supposedly better able to cope with the growing debt than their poorer counterparts. Angola, for example, effectively shut out of global markets, is racing to strike a deal with the Chinese, but even that might not be enough to prevent a painful debt crisis. Sri Lanka, locked in recession, needs to make $4 billion in debt payments this year with only $6 billion in the bank. Brazil's debt, worsened by a yawning budget deficit, has surged to a crippling 95% of the gross domestic product GDP, raising alarm over the medium-term ability of the Latin American giant to stay afloat. The International Monetary Fund and the World Bank have sought to aid the most vulnerable countries, and the world's wealthiest nations endorsed a plan in October to extend the suspension of debt payments owed to them by the poorest countries. In November, those nations additionally agreed to jointly work towards some form of debt relief for the poorest nations that seek it from them, and also encourage private lenders to follow suit. But analysts say that may not be enough. According to the International Monetary Fund, 38 low-income countries are either in debt distress or at high risk of falling into it. Unless private creditors and wealthy nations set up and agree to concessions or outright debt forgiveness, the pandemic's fiscal shock could hurl some of those, as well as highly leveraged middle-income countries such as Costa Rica, towards catastrophic national bankruptcies. Analysts argue that the need for stimulus to keep economies running during this historically challenging period still outweighs the need to balance budgets. Even the International Monetary Fund, the global guardian of fiscal rectitude, is telling countries that now is not the time to scrimp, lest they jeopardize still fragile economic recoveries. Yet, even if a repeat of the cascading financial crises seen in Latin America and Asia in the 1980s and 1990s is avoided, the debt surge threatens to linger as a millstone around the necks of nations for years. It will compromise their ability to fight the first global increase in extreme poverty since the 1990s, and to invest in infrastructure projects such as education and innovation down the line. Zambia, once a shining example of Africa's economic renaissance, is now the ghost of crisis future for debt-burdened countries slammed by the coronavirus pandemic. The sub-Saharan African nation fell into default in November, a result of its high reliance on foreign debt, a pandemic blow to the price of copper, its main commodity, and one of its worst droughts in 40 years. The country is now printing money to survive, forcing a devaluation of its currency, kwacha, and creating spiraling inflation that's spreading misery at the worst possible time. At the government's cancer disease hospital in Lusaka, the capital of Zambia, doctors say the price of imported drug treatments have doubled. According to a household survey in July, a third of the country's workers have lost their wages, 39% were skipping a meal, and 67% are worried about not having enough food to eat. Sakala Zulu, a 26-year-old teacher from eastern Zambia, said staple food such as eggs and sugar now cost 60% more than just 3 months ago, making it harder to feed his six children. The cost of transport for the 12-mile commute to and from work has risen by 20%. Sakala Zulu said, "Right now, I feel there is no part of my life not affected." Zambia is seeking to restructure its debt, but private creditors have shown little willingness to budge. A move to renegotiate substantial loans from China has been cloaked in secrecy. As things stand, more than half of the government spending this year is earmarked for servicing debt alone, leaving little for social programs and spending on healthcare and education. Ishmael Zulu of the advocacy group Cuts International said, "What you see now on the ground is reduced spending on key social sectors," he added. "With the high levels of poverty in Zambia, there are many people that are heavily reliant on government programs. These programs are suffering at the cost of increased debt levels. Hospitals that are in small districts and the far-flung areas of the country are suffering at the cost of increased debt servicing." Half a world away, Costa Rica is scrambling to avoid a similar fate. When the pandemic hit, tourism, the country's economic lifeblood, dried up, and unemployment skyrocketed to more than 24%, draining state coffers of healthcare contributions, just as the Costa Rican government was struggling to respond to the coronavirus pandemic. A tax break for hard-hit businesses and financial aid to out-of-work Costa Ricans dug the fiscal hole deeper. The ensuing cash crunch forced hard decisions for the government, including emergency cuts. At El Jardin Elementary School in northern Costa Rica, Principal Elizabeth Mejia says the operating budget was slashed in half. Teachers are buying their own printers, ink cartridges, and paper to distribute assignments to students. School Principal Elizabeth Mejia said she's been told by the government to hold fundraisers to cover maintenance costs. "They tell us that if we need to fix something, that we should go and sell our assets." In the years after the Great Recession of 2008, Costa Rica ran up deficits and debt to sustain expansive state payrolls and progressive policies. 2 years ago, the government attempted what economists describe as a fiscal band-aid, a new value-added tax, VAT, and limits on salary increases for state workers. Those measures paled in comparison with proposal last year when the government of President Carlos Alvarado Quesada, seeking to boost its bid for a $1.75 billion IMF bailout, sought broad tax increases in the middle of the coronavirus pandemic. Protesters hit the streets of Costa Rica, blocking intersections nationwide, clashing with police officers and slowing commerce in a country that had only recently come out of lockdown. Gerardo Zuniaga, an activist who joined the protests with a mask on his face, said, "People don't have money to pay their debts. Businesses don't have money to pay for supplies, their employees, their permits, and all the social contributions." Gerardo Zuniaga said, "We understand that there has to be some agreement with the International Monetary Fund, but what we don't agree with are items where the most vulnerable people are harmed." The Costa Rican government backed off that proposal and is now in talks with the opposition, unions, civic activists, and industrial groups to find a more palatable solution. But to avoid a painful default like the one the country suffered in 1981, when runaway inflation and spikes in poverty sparked a lost decade, something's got to give. With tourism not expected to recover fully for many years, politicians and businesses are pushing sources of revenue that run afoul of Costa Rica's renowned environmentalism. They include open-pit gold mining, effectively an ecological trade-off for what supporters estimate would be 6,500 direct and indirect jobs and a $9.52 billion jolt for the economy. In August, lawmakers pushed another controversial option, opening Costa Rica lands and shorelines to fracking and oil drilling. Costa Rican lawmaker Patricia Villegas said during a congressional debate, "Our marine territory is 10 times larger than our landmass, and we know little about its riches," she added. "We have sources of energy that we exploit, like hydroelectric energy, wind energy, geothermal, and solar, but we haven't wanted to discuss the possibility of taking advantage of gas and oil." Costa Rica is sitting on a gold mine. In a country that pledged to rely entirely on renewable energy sources by 2030, the debt debate is pitting the country's economic future against cherished environmental ideals and goals. Activists and the government say any boost in oil and natural gas exploration runs counter to everything the country has worked for. They say the nation must find other ways. Elian Villegas, Costa Rica's finance minister, said, "We've launched a decarbonization plan to the world, and those things are fundamental to us as a nation, not just cosmetic." He added, "I find those solutions to be very distant from the essence of being a Costa Rican."
Food for thought.
Hello everyone, and let us ponder on prophetic remarks of Hazrat Fatima Zahra, peace be upon her, the Immaculate Daughter of the Almighty's last and greatest messenger, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. I am from the brightness of Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, knowing all past and future events till the day of judgment.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life. Axel Djawadi talks about the various keys of life and has brought about this book to be a companion for the very famous Mafatil Jiran, where one is a tool or the keys for paradise, and this book, of course, are the keys of life.
The Keys of Life, a program designed to tell you that what Islam gives you will help get you home with joy and faithfulness. So, well, listen to
The Keys of Life.
The world is a very, very big house. Many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up. We must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. My name is Sheikh Zaid Al Salami. A few years ago, I started the course of wanting to commentate on a very important book that I believe is something that would be useful for everyone who reads it, and that is the book Mafatih Al Hayat, written by Ayatollah Al-Uzma Al-Sheikh Djawadi Amuli. Chapter 7 is an interesting topic, talking about clothes and the etiquette of dressing. The whole point about what it is that Islam says as far as the adab, the etiquette of clothing and dressing, is that Muslims should, number one, make sure that you are wearing clean clothes, that your clothes are clean, that the quality is good. You know, these are the 4 points that Ayatollah Djawadi Amuli says. He says, important point from based on summarizing these ahadith. Number one, nawafa, cleanliness. Number two, that you choose good quality clothes. Number three, that you stay simple, be simple. You know, you can choose a good quality piece of clothing that ranges in a reasonable price. Doesn't hit into the thousands, which is far from being reasonable. You know, I don't want to mention brands and things like that, or even currencies, you know, but we understand that this is something reasonable. That is not reasonable in any way. So that level of basata and that level of simplicity in life, or sada zist, as Sheikh Djawadi Amuli says, is always important for us to remember, which is point number three. So cleanliness, good qualities, simplicity. And fourth is to avoid extravagance and wasting. Don't go after luxury. Oppose what it is that Ahlul Kitab wear. Now, of course, here there's an explanation that's given where Sheikh Djawadi mentions that, and at that time, Ahlul Kitab, they would wear something that resembles a boot that would be very, very long and these kind of things. Where, and Muslims, they should be showing themselves in that kind of sense where, you know, they are proud to have their heritage, their culture, their things like that. And they shouldn't be wearing clothes that resemble another identity. That's the important thing here. You know, nowadays, does wearing a pair of pants or a buttoned-up shirt resemble Ahlul Kitab? The answer is no. So some of these ahadith, or if you were to wear boots, for example, these days, does it resemble Ahlul Kitab? The answer is no. So we need to understand these ahadith within the correct context of Zaman and Makan as well. You know, that's an important point for us to always remember. You know, when it does come to certain things, is it appropriate for you to be wearing? You know, I always remember the, you know, famous kind of Arabic proverb, and my father used to always say this to me regularly. He says, eat that which you like, this Arabic proverb, eat that which you like and wear that which others approve of, or others like, others approve of, you know, because you're always going to be there out there in the public. You know, you don't want to be wearing certain things where you are going to put yourself in a situation where people will start talking bad about you or maybe even backbiting you.
Ayatollah Javadi Amali, the author of the book Mafatih al-Hayat, The Keys of Life. This book, Mafatih, ought to be in two volumes. One volume, the present volume, Mafatih al-Janan, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc. But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree. Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam, who has stressed out the reward for praying, has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment. When growing wheat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned. We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
Hadith from Imam Ali alayhi salam, and this is also very, very interesting as well, you know, and that goes to the whole, all the details of these beautiful ahadith. He says, فَإِذَا نَزَعَ أَحَدُكُمْ ثَوْبَهُ فَلْيَطْوِهِ. If you take off your clothes, you should fold it. You know, when you're taking your piece of clothing off, don't just take it off. When you're taking it off, fold it as well. You know, be neat, be tidy. Okay, here, again, here it's talking about your shoes. What are you wearing on your feet? The hadith from Imam Ali alayhi salam, he says, وَلْيُجَوِّدْ الْحِذَاءَ وَلْيُخَفِّفَ الرِّدَاءَ. You should wear أَجْوَدُ الْحِذَاءَ. You should wear a good quality piece, a pair of shoes. وَلْيُخَفِّفَ الرِّدَاءَ. And wear something light when it comes to your shirt, when your clothes. Long hadith from Imam al-Rida salamullahi alayhi, where he says that when you are wearing your clothes, you should start wearing it from your right side. You know, it's the mustahab, start wearing it from your right side. And when you are wearing something new, you should recite Inna anzalnahu fi laylatil qadr 10 times and Qul huwa Allahu ahad 10 times, Qul ya ayyuhal kafirun 10 times. And very interesting hadith that speaks about how we look at clothes as well, as far as appreciating what it is that a person wears. Now, what type of clothing or what color clothing should a person wear? We know that it is makruh to wear black, except if it is for hijab, except if it is for mourning, especially for mourning of Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam, and except if it is a aba'a, if it's a cloak, or except if it's a turban, a imama as well. Here Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alihi, he says, لَيْسَ مِن لِبَاسِكُمْ شَيْءٌ أَحْسَنُ مِنَ الْبَيَاضِ. There is nothing better as far as cloth color is concerned. There is nothing better than to wear white. والحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين.
Driving past, walking fast to the field of dreams. Hear the children scream.
There was The Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents a different image in my mind. A momentary emotion, space spent in time, in time. Memories fade like a dusty window pane, and you can't see your past no more. The only thing that remains is that feeling of warmth in your heart that will always be there, be there.
Hello and welcome back to The Light. Taking care of one's dental health is an absolute must, no matter humans or animals. A 14-year-old Siberian tiger has undergone a dental operation in a French zoo. The dentist took good care of the animal and even administered eye drops so that his eyes would not go dry during the procedure. Baikal broke his fangs 7 years ago while playing around, prompting the zoo owners to have her tooth revitalized and filled. The operation was successful, and the playful cat is now enjoying a brand new fang.
Now, while the world has been riveted by the adventure of NASA's Mars rover, a group of Swiss school children has been eagerly preparing their own mission to the Red Planet. The children have simulated a mission to Mars with the help of some space experts, including Switzerland's sole astronaut, Claude Nicollier. Their rocket is actually a bus with images of astronauts astride a spaceship. And their destination? Well, a Mars space station, conveniently situated, that is, in a secluded wooded area on the outskirts of Lausanne. In a bid to simulate a true space mission, all the children's meals consist of freeze-dried food and are put in an environment they don't know. The school principal says the experiment is aimed at validating what the students have learnt, including maths and science. Now, a volcano near Iceland's Reykjanes Peninsula erupts after being inactive for almost 900 years. The Icelandic Meteorological Office says the eruption was anticipated, though, following thousands of smaller earthquakes in the area in recent weeks. The office says the eruption posed no immediate danger to local people or to critical infrastructure. This comes over a decade after the eruption of another volcano in Iceland disrupted some 900,000 flights across Europe and forced hundreds of Icelanders to flee their homes.
March 22nd is a very important day, but many of us may not be aware of that. The 60-meter picture shows an Ethiopian girl carrying water that was created ahead of the World Water Day, the international occasion falling on March 22nd. A group of artists made the landmark in northern England to raise awareness about climate change and the global water crisis.
Interspersed in the drawing is like a cracked turf to symbolise the drought that climate change will cause. And then the metaphor, if you like, is that the sea is coming in, the rising tide is the rising sea levels that we're going to face in the future.
The artwork was made in collaboration with WaterAid, that's an international NGO focusing on water, sanitation and hygiene. The project supervisors say the main goal is to raise awareness about the importance of water in children's lives. They say they also want to raise attention that how climate change is affecting people's access to water.
It must be exciting to experience a real-world version of a game. Let's go to Japan to see what it's like to be Mario. Fans of the classic Super Mario games are delighted as Nintendo's first-ever theme park has opened in the western city of Osaka. Visitors can gather virtual coins and defeat villains while exploring the park with a smart wristband. One of the park's main draws is a Mario Kart ride around the castle of Mario's enemy, Bowser.
We perfectly recreated the world of the game. You can feel what it's like to be inside of the game and enjoy the life-sized world. You'll find piranha plants, and you'll see what it is like to be Mario.
Visitors can also meet life-size characters from the Mushroom Kingdom and grab a bite in Mario-themed restaurants. The attraction is part of the Universal Studios Japan Amusement Park. Its opening was delayed repeatedly from last summer due to the coronavirus pandemic. A Crimean powerlifter has set a Russian record for pulling a giant airplane. The powerlifter managed to pull an amphibian aircraft weighing 31.5 tons. He did so over the distance of more than a meter at a military base near the city of Sevastopol. The strongman suffered serious injuries during the first attempt on Tuesday when he pulled the plane for 31 centimeters. With the fourth attempt later in the day, he pulled it to 1 meter and 12 centimeters in just 40 seconds. The record was confirmed by representatives of the Record Book of Russia.
An archaeological team has discovered new ruins in Egypt. The discovery reveals a monastic life in the country's western deserts in the 5th century. The Egyptian Antiquities Ministry says the discoveries include ruins of three churches with graffiti and symbols on walls. It says the religious inscriptions and the Greek biblical passages prove the nature of life at that time. The mission was carried out by a group of French-Norwegian archaeologists. The find offers better understanding of the development of buildings and the formation of the first monastic communities. In recent months, Egypt has announced several major archaeological discoveries, hoping to revitalize its tourism industry. School children from Spain and Portugal have been learning how to combine sports with science. They have now put their knowledge and skills to the test by racing their electric cars. The contest was held between nine teams outside Athletic Bilbao's San Mamés Stadium. However, the goal wasn't to see who could drive the fastest. Rather, the strategy was to use their battery power as efficiently as possible. The team that completed as many laps as possible in 90 minutes was declared the winner. Driving the car too fast could quickly drain the batteries.
Apart from being fun and interesting, you can learn mechanics, electrics, and then you can compete. You learn things from the realm of engineering, more things for the future. I usually say that the electric car is the future, but others will make hybrids in order to maintain speed and design and the engine type.
The cars are powered by twin lead-acid batteries that supply 24 volts to a 240-watt electric motor. The teams don't have to build their cars from scratch because a basic kit is supplied to them. However, they have to modify the vehicle mechanically, electrically, and aerodynamically. The project started in the UK in the 1990s. It seeks to raise awareness in young people about alternative energy sources, climate change, and pollution issues. Let's go to the US, where a baby giraffe has explored his habitat at the Indianapolis Zoo for the first time. In a sunny day, Candy playfully made his first public appearance along with his mother and the herd. The cute calf was born in November and has no siblings yet. Giraffes are native to sub-Saharan Africa, so the zookeepers only allow them to be outside when the weather is not wet or cold. Two tiny islands in South Korea have become tourist attractions by turning almost everything to purple. They are now known as Purple Islands. Banwol and Bakji Islands used to be abandoned locations with small populations of elderly people. But everything changed when residents launched a popular campaign there in 2015. Inspired by their native balloon flower, they started painting the houses, roads and bridges in different shades of purple. They planted more purple flowers on the islands and wore clothes with the same color. Restaurants on the islands also started serving purple food.
We couldn't travel overseas due to COVID-19, so we thought about a local trip instead and found these purple islands. It's amazing and looks like fairy tales and magic. As I'm seeing, the grandmas are all wearing purple clothes. It is very dreamy.
The tourists also praised the welcoming spirit of the islanders, who offer a free entry to the visitors dressed in purple. The campaign has changed the island's